BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show has come to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. What a cold week it's been. Not only is it freezing outside, it's freezing inside. Somebody's half-inched our radiator and eaten our prawn crackers. Nightmare. Tonight we have Tony Gosling interviewing Helen Reed. Malcolm Grieve continues our new serial, The History of the Mathia, and Anthea Page is in South America and has a report from Buenos Aires, and Jeff Sparks is here again with another What's On Guide. To beat those January blues, of course. I'm looking forward to those being over. I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show. Our first feature today is from Tony Gosling, who is interviewing Helen Reed about her career in journalism.
I'm Helen Reed, and I joined the Evening Post in 1959 after graduating with an English degree from Bristol University. And I hadn't a clue what I wanted to do for a living. I'd never considered journalism. And I went down to the Labour Exchange and they said, "Have you thought about being a journalist?" And it turned out that Richard Hawkins, who was the editor of the Evening Post at the time, was new to editing and didn't know about the Press Gazette. So he told them, Labour Exchange, he'd got a vacancy, and they sent me along and I got the job. And I had a hard time joining the union. I wanted to right from the start, but they wouldn't let me in because of my unconventional background. I had no training, wasn't usual to have graduates, and I had to sort of prove myself for about 2 years that I was earning a living from writing before they would let me in.
So what sort of an editor was he to work under?
In some ways, very enlightened, very keen on culture. I mean, he had Tom Stoppard working for him at one stage, and so he got a great arts page going in the Western Daily Press. But he wasn't really a newsman, and I don't think his heart was in it.
So what happened then? Maybe you could just take us back to those days when you first started. Whereabouts was the paper, for a start? Where was it based?
Right, the Evening Post then was in a terrible building in Silver Street in Broadmead, and we worked in a room that had holes in the floors where rats had chewed it, and we had those lamps and tubes going all over the room, and copy boys running about, and it was...
Those tubes, what are they?
Lamps and tubes where you sent copy down to the typesetters, to the printers. Pneumatic tubes. You filled a little canister with your copy, your typewritten copy, and it whizzed through the tubes down the building. One thing that was very noticeable was that it was almost all male. There were three women working. There was me doing general stuff and two women's editors, one for each paper. And that stayed true for a good long time. I mean, nowadays, I mean, there are probably more women than men, but then you were really on your own. And I think that made a great difference because the pay structure. I worked for years for the Western Daily Press, not knowing that I was getting several thousand a year less than the men, because Eric Price, who was the editor of the Western Daily Press, used to tell me that men had got mortgages and children to support and I didn't need the money and they did. Though theoretically we had equal pay, it was far from unequal. And that sort of led to the first attempt to get a house agreement, which I was very much part of.
So what initially drew you to being part of the union? Why did you think it was something that was worth joining?
Well, I felt we had to act as a group and we had to have common objectives. And, you know, nobody ever talked about pay and conditions. It was all, you know, you went to see the editor on your own and you did your own deals, and soon struck us as being very unfair that if you did the job, there should be a rate for that job. And we gradually got together a pay claim, which came as quite a shock to the management. I mean, Walter Hawkins and the Evening Post directors were very nice, benevolent people and very civilised to work for, but they didn't really consider that we had rights. I mean, we and the first negotiations were quite difficult.
So how did the management take that when you sort of presented this fait accompli, you know, a pay request or pay demand on the table?
Well, it wasn't a demand. We wanted a proper pay structure that rewarded you for what you were doing, not who you were. And I think it was just a new idea. They weren't difficult or unpleasant about it. And gradually, when it settled down, we got negotiations going every year very amicably. It worked quite well.
So just take us back again to the sort of building you were working in and working with the printers as they were in those days. What was it like for those youngsters coming into the business now? Can you explain what it was like working with the much older technology and in quite difficult conditions?
Well, yes, it was an awful building with terrible dark staircases with holes in them, and the printers were really sort of raced apart. You had to be very careful not to upset them, not to pick up bits of type and so on and ask silly questions. Really, we didn't have much relationship with the printers. It was like going back into the Industrial Revolution, the hot metal type setting and so on. And I don't think we realised its days were numbered until we moved over to the new building, which we're in now, in 1972 or 1, I think it was.
So was the move to the new building part of the buy-up of the shares in the old Evening Post by the Associated Newspapers, the Daily Mail, or not?
No, it wasn't. It was still Bristol United Press. It was still the old management that started the paper. Gradually the shares got sold off, and they fought it hard. I mean, it was a family business and they loved it, but there wasn't a son to take over. Their ethos became old-fashioned, I think they made money, but not as much as they could have done if they were managed by somebody like Northcliffe.
How did the move to the new building go?
Oh, that was nice. I mean, it was such a luxury after what we had. We had such a terrible building. Everyone liked it. It was very luxurious. But what was looming was new technology, of course. And I was part of the... I was, in fact, deputy FOC of our chapel when we went on strike in 1978, in the winter of 1978, there was snow on the ground. We had a caravan outside and a brazier and the police every night.
So what brought about the strike? What ran up? Could you just take us up to that? What happened?
Well, it was the management wanted to introduce computers, obviously, the new technology. And so for once, we and the printers were all on the same side because they were resisting it. And... really, it was to get paid for making the change that we went out for 6 weeks, I think it was, and it was pretty solid. We had some IOJ members who went on working, and they had a very nasty time, I can tell you, because the spirit of that strike was just fantastic. We were really fired up, all of us.
So you were galvanised really behind the idea of stopping computers being introduced, but surely it was going to be inevitable.
No, we knew it was inevitable, but we wanted to be paid the rate for doing it. I mean, not be paid typewriting rates. And the key to all this, of course, was the printers. I mean, we'd never have had any stop the paper coming out. We didn't really very often stop it, but we delayed it. But the printers were absolutely key to this. And they were pretty good, pretty solid, because they were facing big job losses. And so every day we got the printers to delay going in by chatting them up with giving them their case, and all the van drivers, when the papers came out, we got the police to allow 3 minutes each, and since there were a great many vans, that delayed the paper quite a lot. But the people left inside the building managed to get a paper of sorts out.
Yeah, maybe you could just describe what the newspaper was like under the strike conditions. Was it just all adverts and a few little bits of wire copy?
It was lots of wire copy and big pictures and so on. But, I mean, they got a paper out. It was a smaller paper than usual, but they did.
And so how did that resolve itself?
In the end, they caved in and agreed to talks, and we all got quite handsome increases in exchange for being trained.
And was that under the old management still? That,
yes.
Was that,
yes. Yes, it was still under the old management, yes.
I mean, we were talking about the same newspaper, but obviously the character of the management is quite different. Can you maybe talk about that a bit?
Oh, I don't think I should, actually, because I'm not on the staff and I don't really see it day to day. I mean, I just get the impression that it's much, much harsher and rigid about rules and so on. And, you know, you put a notice up, it's taken down, that sort of thing. With the changeover from the old Evening Post to being owned by Northcliffe is most noticeable in the fact that it's a big monolithic organisation and you don't know people anymore. We knew the owners, we knew the directors and all the admin staff and so on. Now it's all distant. And, I mean, they don't know who you are. And that's a big difference. But you actually had some personal relationship with the people who owned the paper, and that's gone, I think.
Would you have any advice for youngsters just coming into the business? I mean, I know it's a difficult question, but for someone just starting out in journalism and the way it is today, what tips have you got for youngsters?
Go out and talk to people. Don't rely on the internet and the phone, I would say. That's what's so noticeable is that when I was a young reporter, the room would be empty because we'd be all out on stories. Now the room is full and they're all on the phone. Or you know, looking at Google, and really, there's nothing to beat going out and meeting people. If you want to get the story and the flavour of a story, you must go out.
How did you make the transition into the features side from doing news?
I deputised for the women's editor while she was on holiday, and the editor liked my stuff and took me on as a feature writer.
And what's the difference between news and features, do you think? What's, you know, what's the quality? Do you enjoy it more?
Oh, much more, yes. I mean, you can use much more imagination. You're not so hidebound by rules and facts and so on. You can use your opinions, which is much, much more, and talk to people on a different level. When you're just chasing facts, it's not the same as getting at their inner feelings and so on. I think one tip, if you're interviewing a celeb, is to do your homework very carefully. I used to interview authors quite often, and they would be astounded and they'd say, "You actually read the book," which apparently is unusual. Things like that. I used to do a lot of sort of big set pieces, like the Princess Di's wedding, and that was an ordeal and a half, I can tell you, because no laptops, no mobiles. So we had a London office as a base, but you had to, you know, tear between Westminster Abbey. Was it Westminster or was it St Paul's? Must have been Westminster, I can't remember. And then tear down Fleet Street, type it all out, and get someone to put it on the wire for you. Whereas, you know, now you can practically do it instantly on the spot. It was hard body work.
For young people getting into the business now, do you think the union has still got a role?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, more than ever, I think, yeah. Because with these big employers, with their monolithic structures and ways of doing things, you know, they really do not want to know. They see it as subversive to join a union, and they can get away with things that they shouldn't get away with.
So what sort of thing? I mean, you know, if you're not in a union, how is it going to affect you, do you think, if you're not actually part of the union? Is it really going to make a difference?
You're going to have to make deals on your own, and you're in the dark about what other people are getting, what other rates are, you know, conditions and so on. I think you should always negotiate from the strength of a large group.
That was Dialect's reporter Tony Gosling talking to Helen Reid about her career in journalism. Now we have some music from Bob Dylan, and this is the song Subterranean Homesick Blues.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, badge out, laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie comes fleet-foot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bedbug, phone's tapped in.
But walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that carry around a fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash your plain clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Oh, get sick, get well, hang around the inkwell, hang bell, hard to tell if anything is gonna sell. Try hard, get boxed, get back, ride rail, get jailed, jump bail, join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, six-time users, hanging around the theaters, girl by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool, don't follow leaders, or watch your parking meters.
Thank you to Mr. Zimmerman, and he's still going strong. Fop Records have copies of his latest album, Modern Times, on a lovely big LP for only £6. What a bargain. It's time for Malcolm... Well, that sounds a bit like product placement, or brand placement, perhaps, but they are good. It's time now for Malcolm Grieve to read us part two of The History of the Mafia.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. Now, organised crime group has more of a mystique than the Italian Mafia. Yet the Italian Mafia does not in any concrete way exist. At one level, it is just a shorthand phrase to describe the wide range of very real Italian organized crime groups, ranging from the actual Sicilian Mafia to the 'Ndrangheta from Calabria and the less often mentioned Mala del Brenta of Venice. In Italy, the phrase Mafia has become not only a synonym for all organized crime groups in the country, but also a term used to describe the web of collusion and corruption associated with them that reaches from the lowest to the highest levels of Italian society. In many senses, Mafia has become a brand name associated with everything of the underworld. Violence, power, money, conspiracy, secrecy, and blood. However, the Mafia brand also carries connotations of tradition, family, masculinity, and above all, honour. Much of the aura that surrounds the Mafia in Italy stems from the fact that although it has now become a nationwide criminal network, it is composed of organised crime gangs that have their roots in and still often function as age-old secret societies. This taps into the deep-rooted Italian belief in potere occulto, hidden power, the idea that there is a clandestine group guiding the hand of those visible in authority. The mythology of the Mafia has become so entrenched in Italian culture that it is almost part of the national heritage. Alongside the Mafia's money and violence, the folklore is a powerful tool for inspiring fear and promoting silence. You can tell that organised crime has achieved true power in Italy when the mere use of the word Mafia can silence those you are talking with. Anyone who claims they can give a definitive and totally accurate history of the origins of the Mafia is mistaken. There is no fully comprehensive and perfect account of the genesis of the various Italian organised crime groups that have become collectively known as the Mafia. No one can even give a definitive origin for the word Mafia. Criminal organisations are not like town councils. They do not keep minutes, and they do not do paperwork. That would be a guaranteed route to prison or execution. This therefore makes the job of the criminal historian in trying to trace where, when, and why an organised crime group came into being exceptionally difficult. The problem is compounded when investigating the Sicilian Mafia and other Italian criminal networks, as many of them started out as secret societies that went to great lengths to keep not just their membership and activities concealed, but also tried to hide the fact that they existed at all. Given this, what follows is the best verifiable historical fact, allied to the most accepted and reasonable speculation. One defining and unifying characteristic of the longest established Italian organized crime groups is the use of ritual and ceremony, more commonly associated with secret societies. While blood oaths are common across the Mediterranean, the complexity and shared elements of the rituals used by the Camorra, Ndrangheta and Sicilian Mafia suggest a common point of origin. Some believe the rituals were imported and adapted from French Freemasonry into political groups opposed to the Bourbon regime based in Naples around 1820. However, this is almost certainly wrong. When Giuseppe Balsamo left Palermo and Sicily in the 1760s and travelled across Europe, styling himself as the adventurer, occultist and master Freemason Comte di Cagliostro, he took with him from the island knowledge of a set of rituals and ceremonies that are very close to some of those used by Italian crime groups today. Cagliostro claimed the rituals came from the Knights of Malta, who had received them from the Knights Templar. Templar rituals also influenced the creation of Freemasonry. Given the large presence the Knights Templar had in Sicily and elsewhere on the Italian Mediterranean coast, it is more probable that the arcane oaths and ceremonies used by the Mafia today originated not in France, but in Sicily or Italy itself. It is also worth remembering that the earliest historical mentions of organised crime groups, such as the Sicilian Mafia, refer to them as sects. While the origins of the early sects may date back several hundred years, the direct link between them and the Camorra, Ndrangheta and Sicilian mafia crime families probably dates back no earlier than the 1810s. Organised brigands, playing a role in the vicious politics of the Bourbon regime and later Italian unification, helped create groups that sought a profitable place between the peasants and landlords in a country that was emerging relatively late from the bonds of feudalism. They adopted the trappings of established secret societies as a convenient cloak of camouflage and a useful tool for keeping members in line. The rapid growth in Italy of protection rackets, monopolies, exploitation of corrupt government power, and provision of the illicit can all be traced back to the years post-1860. There is extensive mythologizing about the origins of Italian organized crime groups. The fact that the name 'Ndrangheta comes from the Greek word 'andrangathia, meaning heroism and virtue, and members of the Sicilian mafia refer to themselves as belonging to the honored society, gives a strong indication of where most of the mythology comes from. This mythologizing can be seen in suggestions of where the word mafia itself comes from. Some mafiosi claim it is a corruption of the Arabic mu'afa, meaning a refuge or to protect, and refers to Sicilian resistance to occupation of the island by the Moors between 9th and 12th century. Others claim it is an acronym of Morte alla Francia, Italia Anelia, roughly translated as Death to France, Italy Cries. The more prosaic truth, however, is that it probably comes from the Palermo dialect word mafioso, meaning self-confident, something the earliest Sicilian gangsters most certainly were. Part of the power of criminal networks in Italy comes from the mystique that surrounds them. In Italian consciousness, they exist not just as criminals, but also as a people apart from the rest of the world. Having rejected conventional morality and laws, there is awareness that members of organized crime groups are governed by a clandestine code. Beyond the obvious secrecy of criminality, below the separation that comes from living in the underworld, Italians know that members of the Mafia, Camorra and 'Ndrangheta inhabit a distinct, covert culture with its own words, symbolism and regulations that give such groups an intense atmosphere of mystery. The rituals and ceremonies at the heart of many Italian organized crime groups may seem bizarre to most people, but to anyone who has been involved with Freemasonry, they will seem reassuringly familiar. In both Freemasonry and Sicilian Mafia, 'Ndrangheta and Camorra initiation rites, the prospective member undergoes a symbolic death and rebirth. They die from their old life and are reborn into the organization and make an oath to always obey the rules of their new family, knowing that disobedience may mean death. The ritual involves having to hold the burning image of a saint and reciting an oath of total secrecy and obedience. Next, his direct boss as a mafia soldier, his capo, will take a knife and cut his hand. The burning is symbolic of the death of his old life, and the blood signifies his birth into his new mafia family. The rules a new initiate is expected to follow until his dying day, unless he wants to invite death, all revolve around obedience, honour, and omerta, or silence. Members learn that their crime family comes before their old family, God, or the state. They must always obey the orders of the head of the family, or their capo. They must ask permission on all important matters and decisions, whether it is the starting of a new criminal enterprise, or the choice of a wife. They must never lie to another member of the family in any matter. They can never introduce themselves to other mafiosi as a mafiosi. Instead, a member who is known to both parties must introduce them, often using the code of Amico Nostra, meaning a friend of ours, from which the name Cosa Nostra, meaning our thing, comes. They must never show disrespect to a member or their womenfolk, and above all, they must never speak of anything related to the family to anyone outside of it.
Thank you very much to the actor Malcolm Grieve for his reading of the history of the Mafia, and we look forward to more next week. We have some music now. This is the Canadian band Rush with a song titled The Larger Bowl.
If we're so much the same like I always hear, why such different fortunes and fates? Some of us live in a cloud of fear, some live behind iron gates. Why such different fortunes and fates? Some are blessed and some are cursed. Some live behind iron gates, while others see only the worst.
A lot of pain on this earth, it's somehow so badly arranged. Some things can never be changed, some reasons will never come clear. It's somehow so badly arranged. If we're so much the same, like I always hear, some are blessed and some are cursed. Golden one or scarred from
Canadian legends there, and one of their tracks from yesteryear. People all around the world have been horrified in recent times by the recent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, which killed many civilians, including women and children. Dialect's reporter Anthea Page joined the demonstration in the Avenue de Mayo in the centre of Buenos Aires in South America and brings us this report from the streets of the city.
Esta es la pelea. Al sionismo se lo enfrenta en Gaza, pero todos somos Gaza y acá es Gaza. Compañeros, compañeras, como dijimos al comienzo de este acto de repudio, es fundamental desarrollar todas las acciones de solidaridad con el pueblo palestino y sus organizaciones combatientes. Por eso, compañeros, sionismo es racismo. ¡Hasta la victoria siempre! Compañeros, nos encontramos en la próxima.
Oh my God, they're setting fire to the flags of Israel and America now. Tell me your name and your part in this event.
my paper in this event. I am from an assembly, and I am Jewish, and I'm not agree with this war. I disagree absolutely. Then I think I have to say that in public.
Yeah. And who are the people who've organized the demonstration?
Yes, the demonstration is for people, socialism, and Trotskyism. And now I am inviting to the people of the Jewish community to come here. A lot of people that do not think, they are not, they not agree with war. And I want them to be here with me. This is my paper.
So, are there any other demonstrations happening around South America, or is it just in Buenos Aires today?
In other countries?
I
think in several countries, every day are demonstrations. We are going to do another next Thursday.
Oh, every Thursday?
Next Thursday, here and in Plaza de Mayo, yes.
What about the government?
Yes.
How do the government, what's their view on the war? Are they for the Israelis, or do they take any part?
They say nothing. We want to, they have to say their opinion, sincerely opinion, no? But they prefer to shut their
mouth.
Stay quiet.
And
yes.
How many people do you think there are here today?
Today, yeah. I think 5,000.
5,000?
Yes,
lots
yes.
of women, children,
yes.
everybody.
Everybody, every families and children, everybody.
What's going to happen? Is there going to be a procession?
No, with every organization is going to their house.
Now it's finished.
Now it's finished, yes.
And thank you to Anthea Page for her work there from the streets of Buenos Aires.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Jeff Sparks is here with us again for another edition of his What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is a What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 30th of January, and at the Beer Keller in Bristol, Extreme Noise Terror will be performing with support from Disorder. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. Also on 30th of January, and at the Hatchet in Bristol, the Transpersonals will be performing with support from David Marlowe. This will be followed by the Gimme Shelter Club. Doors open at 9:30 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Finally, on 30th of January, and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, Kangaroo Moon will be performing with support from Abel Mabel Band and also Strange Brew. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week I feature the Kinks. This is a track from the album Kink Controversy, which was originally released in 1965, and the track is titled Milk Cow Blues.
Sugar, but I'm gonna do. I'm sick of all your crying for me.
That was the Kinks with Milk Cow Blues from the album Kink Controversy. Moving on to Saturday 31st of January, and at the Moles Club in Bath, Troy Ellis and the Long Shots will be performing. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £3 for early bird tickets, £5 for members, £5.50 for concessions and £6 for guests. You can buy tickets online at www.moles.co.uk. Staying with 31st of January and at the Fleece in Bristol, the Suspects will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 1st of February, and at the Carnation Tap in Bristol, James Morton and the Lunatics will be performing. The gig starts around 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to the ever wonderful Jeff Sparks. And now for some brief music, this is Pink Floyd with a song titled The Gnome.
I want to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome named Grimble Grumble, and little gnomes stay in their homes, eating, sleeping, drinking their wine. He wore a scarlet tunic, a blue-green hood, it looked quite good. He had a big adventure amidst the grass, fresh air at last, whining, dining, biding his time. And then one day, hooray, another way for gnomes to say, look at the sky, look at the river, isn't it good? Look at the sky, look at the river, isn't it good? Winding, finding places to go. And then one day,
well, Sid Barrett's spirit rest in peace. That was The Gnome by Pink Floyd from many years ago. Now it's time to hand over to Christine Ironsides. She read a short story last week and she is here again this week. So this story is called Julia Landers Has a Change of Heart.
Julia Landers was loud, outlandish and stylish. She was also extremely spoilt. Whatever, it seemed, she wanted, her doting parents would give her. It was fine that Julia was so confident, but a little unfine that she was so confident. Contrast this with the humble Rita. She was such a lovely girl. When you saw what a nice girl Rita was, you just couldn't help admiring her parents for doing such a good job bringing her up. I'm afraid Essie was just a little too forthright and slightly outlandish for Rita's taste, but all the same, they did say hi to each other. Actually, Julia had a heart of gold. She was just unable to quite convey that to others around her, because she always learned to look after herself first. This was not a bad thing in itself, and certainly helped her ward off the glooms, which her mother was apt to get, especially after one of Julia's hard-done-by days, when Julia needed something else badly. Essie, how can I love other people as much as I love myself? She once said to Essie at the lunch break over a diet lemonade and her favourite chicken tikka. I don't feel that I don't love other people. It's just I have learned to love myself as much as my parents love me. And it doesn't seem healthy, somehow, not to love other people as much as you can. Well, said Essie, slightly gratified that the amazing and popular Julia Landers had sat beside her and was actually confiding in her and asking Essie's opinion. What you have to do is to try to put yourself in their shoes. If, for instance, you had the same set of circumstances as they had in their life, in yours, how would you cope? Think about that. Then Julia's beautiful golden heart really began to start functioning. Underneath all that superb confidence, that kind of not the average person a little sideways, was a very good person. As she began to put herself in the shoes of other people, realising why they sometimes were a little quirky or plain mean, she grew. Even her nouveau riche roughness, if you could call hard-working people as rough as all that, was mellowed by her sensitivity to others now. For Julia, it was not hard to love or feel loved, because her parents had given her everything they could and loved her to bits. This had given her real assurance of her worth to them, and it was so easy for her to understand that she was a really valuable person as well. Really trying to put herself inside someone else's situation in her mind had made her more understanding and also more able to care. Also, her superb ability to know that she was a valuable person was absolutely what she needed when it came to realising that all the others were as valuable as she was. She even stopped hammering her mother quite so much when necessity called for a massive strop to get a new item on the "what I now need and every girl must have immediately" agenda, which, unknown to Julia, meant that her mother was saved from the brink of alcoholism in the nick of time. Such had been the effects of the massive strops on her. Cripes, Julia's having a bereft of items material again with emphasis, her father would say, these teenage girls these days, and he would head off to the golf club, leaving her mother, a mere golf widow for the day, with the checkbook and a box of elegant tissues to try and sort it out so our baby is happy again, and slightly less of a handful, he would think on. They usually had a TV dinner in those days, frozen lasagna or something, with baked Alaska, so that all could calm down and it would be nice at home again. The next day, Mum needed treating, usually too. But now that Julia had a more understanding heart, all that became unnecessary, and it was somehow nicer too.
Thank you very much to Christine Ironside, and we hope we'll come back again and read you some more stories. Well, now for a little bit of a change of scene from psychedelia and rock, let's hear a little bit of reggae. This is from an artist from recent times in the last couple of years called Mattis Yahu, which is the Ashkenazi Hebrew or Yiddish pronunciation of the biblical name of Matthew. So as you might have figured, this is reggae with a bit of a twist, because Mattis Yahu is an Orthodox Jew. He's become Orthodox Jew in recent times. He's gone through a number of different kinds of Jewishness as he's kind of made his mind up and settled. Originally, he was born Matthew Paul Miller in Pennsylvania and then lived in New York and then spent his difficult teen years taking hallucinogens and following a band called Fish Around on tour. Then he kind of chilled out, became religious and sort of settled into his new persona. And he's released a whole album of reggae tracks, all of which are based around religious themes and his Jewishness. So this is a track called King Without a Crown.
You're all I have and you're all that I need. Each and every day I pray to get to know you. Please wanna be close to you, yes I'm so hungry. You're like water for my soul when it gets thirsty. Without you there's no me or the air that I breathe. Sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. With these demons around all around, I bring me down to negative vibes. But I believe, yes I believe, I said that I believe. Stand on two feet, one beat brought down on one knee. I fight with all of my might and get these demons to flee. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Out of darkness comes light, twilight and to the heights. Crown lights burning up, out of to the twilight. So thank you to my God, now I finally got it right. And I fight with all of my heart and all of my soul and all of my mind. I give myself to you from the essence of my beginning. I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Time it starts a feeling. What's this feeling? My love will be holding a ceiling. I give myself to you from the essence of my beginning. I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Stripping away
the Lakers and reveal your soul. You gotta give yourself up and then you become whole. You're a slave to yourself and them don't even know. Them want to live that fast life but your brain moves slow. If you're trying to stay high, bound to stay low. You want God but you can't deflate your ego. You're already there, then there's nowhere to go. Your cup's already full, then it's bound to overflow. If you're drowning in the waters and you can't stay afloat, ask Hashem for mercy, he'll throw you a rope. You're looking for help from God, yeah, he couldn't be found. Searching up to the sky, looking beneath the ground, like a king without his crown. You'll keep falling down, and really want to leave, but can I get rid of your crown? You're trying to reach onto the heights and run down, bound on the ground. Giving up your pride, then you heard a sound. Out of night comes day, out of day comes light. And I fly to the one like sunlight in the rain. Making room for his love, and a fire gun blaze. Make room for his love, and a fire gun blaze. What's this silly man of who for holy? I give myself to you from the essence of my beginning. I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Time it starts a beating. What's this feeling? My love will be for hole in a ceiling. I give myself to you from the essence of my beginning. I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now.
That was Matty's Yahoo. Obviously, the theme is a little bit different from your average reggae track. He does all of his songs about Orthodox Jewishness and themes around Judaism. So the lyrical content does seem to be a little repetitive, should we say, but he is very good. And he's brought out a live CD, Matty's Yahoo Live at Stubbs, that is available as well. And that proves that he is as good a vocalist and the music is as good live as he is on the CD, which is always refreshing. So look out for more stuff from him. My next track is taken from a CD called The Freak Beat Scene, so this is a little bit of a music loving for Dialect Radio regulars through the quiet January months. And this track is a novelty track that came out. They're a bit of a one-hit wonder. They're a band called Fire, and the track is Father's Name is Dad. And they've got a little bit written inside about the band, so I'll just kind of read you that to give you a little flavour. With its wide-eyed power pop melody and hooish production, Father's Name is Dad could easily define the mod and freakbeat oeuvre, and yet Fire's first single wasn't issued until Spring 68. It's interesting to note that freakbeat is one of these genre names. It was only actually invented, the name freakbeat, in the late 80s, so it wasn't called freakbeat at this time. They probably would have maybe have called it part of the mod scene, I guess, and it would have just been regarded as mod, but maybe a little bit different. They went on to record a concept album for the Pye label, The Magic Shoemaker, with one of their new band members, Paul Brett, and various members of the band all later played with The Straubs, who you'll know from 70s fame. So here they are. Father's Name's Dad by Fire, and with a parental theme. My next track is called Some Mother's Son to finish us off for this week. This is by the Kinks from 1969, from their album Arthur or The Decline and Fall of the British Empire. This is their 1969 album, and came after their album Village Green, where they seem to have a little bit of a bad run of luck, really. Village Green displayed some of his finest, Ray Davies displayed some of his finest songwriting skills, and yet the record company released it with no publicity and no adverts, so no one knew. So they didn't buy it. Nobody bought it. So that kind of didn't go anywhere. And then ITV, or Granada, I should say, approached them with an unusual offer. They wanted them to create a musical television drama, a sort of a brand new thing, for the network's New Colour service. Ray Davies would write with an established writer, so they bandied around a few names like John Betjeman or Alan Bennett, which would have been fascinating. But they wound up putting in with Julian Mitchell, a 33-year-old novelist and playwright, and they started to write a script together about a little man called Arthur. And in his own words, Ray Davies wanted his story to be, or to centre around the whole story, around an ordinary man like himself, he explained. He said, who had been a small cog in the empire and had watched it passing by. So it's like a kind of a life story of this man. Unfortunately, they pulled funding and this never got made. So he made the soundtrack for it and he had an album, and it was going to be released as an original soundtrack, not so much as an album. And it didn't really go anywhere. Because Tommy had just released, The Who had just released Tommy, Sgt. Pepper had come, so the concept album was quite big, and they thought, well, this is kind of the Kinks trying to do like a kind of a concept album that doesn't really give work or go anywhere. So fate was not on their side, sadly. Some lovely songs on the album, particularly one called Australia, which is kind of based around his sister wanting to emigrate to Australia. But the track I've chosen, particularly in light of the wars going on around the world at the moment, particularly with Gaza Strip, and this all sounds rather sombre and serious, but it's a rather sombre and serious song. It's called Some Mother's Son, and if you listen to the lyrics, I'm sure you'll understand what his theme for the song is.
They put his picture on the wall. some mother's memory remains.
Well, there were some of Ray Davies' meanderings and ponderings upon the pointlessness of war and death. And obviously, well, I think we all hope that the conflicts in the Gaza Strip stop as soon as possible. Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio show. Thank you very much to Christine Ironside, who sort of rushed in, a bit blustered from all the wind and the rain at the last minute. We had to chill her out and give her a cup of coffee, and she read us another lovely short story. She's coming in again next week. And just to replug a couple of things that Jeff mentioned in his What's On Guide that I reckon are worth telling you about. Troy Ellis and the Long Shots are playing at the Moles Club in Bath, 31st of January. Certainly, if you live in Bristol, it's only a fiver return on the train. Why not? An Extreme Noise Terror, who I've seen before at the Thecla, they are incredible. 30th of January at the Beer Keller, and that'll be a good laugh. Our features were brought to us by Dialect Radio reporters Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Malcolm read another instalment of the History of the Mafia, our new serial, and that's continued next week. Thank you to Jeff Sparks for his What's On Guide. And Village Church Curran was the studio engineer. This week's show was produced by Jeff Sparks, and you can download the show on the internet at dialectradio.co.uk. It's goodbye from all of us here, and me, John Peters Coleman. Take care of yourselves, and good night.